To us, it would be suicide to not leave. It is to take life to leave this body behind. It is to significantly take life. This is not life to us. This is like living in a civilization that is barbaric, that is primitive in comparison to the level above human.
Welcome to Vict. Oh wait, no, I'm in the wrong place. I haven't been here in a while. Does he go? It's welcome to the PS Midnight Cast,
the show where we talk. The show where we're only chasing the 90s,
where darkness comes to die.
I'm your host, Riff Daddy,
and I'm your other host, Captain Flippin' Nostalgia.
What's up, Captain?
Nothing much, man. We just got done recording for Victims this week. It was great to have you on. I'm like even more pumped for this weekend now because one of my most anticipated films comes out this weekend. So, how are you?
I am pretty good compared to recent weeks, but I'm pretty good, man.
So you get to tell everyone how you got hit in the head.
Well, yeah. I have a few good friends of mine. They're in a hardcore band that's also a professional wrestling theme. They're called Hill Turn. They have an EP. They're recording this weekend, and when it gets out, we'll post it up. But so they played a show the other night, and I only went to see them because I haven't had a chance to see them live. And one of the songs is about, from the 80s, Tully Blanchard. Well, no, I don't think it is about that match. But anyway, the song is about a dog collar match from the 80s. And nobody, Josh, like, had a dog chain, and he was talking about it. And in the group text, we're in. I was like, hey, I'll attach it to myself, and we can pull it to the round of the pit during the show. Well, it actually happened, so this is what you're seeing as you're walking into the show. Someone who doesn't know wrestling and someone who might be new to hardcore. So you're walking in, and first you see on the stage three grown men playing instruments wearing wrestling masks. They wear a wrestling mask. And then when you like get your spot on the floor, you just see two grown men, one in a mask with a microphone, yelling into the microphone with a dog chain, a dog collar hooked around them, with a chain hooked to another guy. Another grown man pulling them each other back and forth, and I let go of it for a second. And when I did, it whipped up, hit me in the cheek, and I know sold that hard. It's a wrestling term for not selling moves.
That story never gets like tiring to hear.
It's pretty funny. I mean, like people at work think I have the most interesting life because the week before that, I was telling everyone that the aliens were in my backyard.
Oh, yeah, that's another great story. That I'm still pissed that you didn't get pictures of, bro. What is wrong with you? You're going to come close to aliens and not take photographic evidence?
Dude, I'm one of those people, when I'm experiencing like great moments in my life, the last thing I'm thinking about is being on my phone taking pictures of it. I want to get the full experience of what's going on in my life. That's why I have such bad concert pictures.
Yes, that's also true. I follow you on Instagram. I was like, because like when you posted about Norma Jean, I was like, man, I was like, what? That's a terrible
picture.
Well,
hey, look, that's all I could get, man. And the video I put on my story was pretty crazy. That was like right there in Corey Brandon's crotch the whole time.
Oh man, please tell me you got a chubby.
I'm not gonna confirm or deny anything. It was a wild show, man. Redeemer, 10-year, y'all. I hope some of y'all listening got to see that. Let us know how you thought about it. It was really fun for me. Oh, man. Feels good to be back.
It does. We haven't been here for a long, long time. And we've
like 6 weeks.
Yeah, 6 weeks. It's so weird because I spent the first couple of weeks this year sick, and then spent the next 6 weeks traveling and just pouring into victims that we kind of just let this kind of go to the wayside because we just got too busy, I guess.
Yeah, and I've been too busy traveling to wrestling shows literally all February long. And, like, I went to Norma Jean last Saturday, and I told my buddies, like, hey, I don't want to travel again until at least when we go to WrestleMania weekend in April. Let March be March. You know, it was all fun, but at the end of, like, the month, I'm like, okay, I need a weekend where I can just relax, not worry about anything.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's here now. We're here now, so, I mean, let's jump in. Last we left off, we were defining cults and talking about the Hellbot comment because we were setting up for a duology of episodes featuring revolving around Heaven's Gate. And we actually recorded the Heaven's Gate episode, and then we discovered the Heaven's Gate podcast and realized...
Also discovered that we didn't really like it, too.
Yeah, we we weren't feeling it, so this is take two for all you guys that follow us. Thank you guys. And if you guys,
and what's the guy's name that does the podcast?
Glenn Washington.
Fantastic. Shout out to him for sparking us up a little bit.
Yeah, fantastic. I found it one of the people in the, it was either the Farsighted Network or the Philadelphia Podcasting Society actually recommended the Heaven's Gate podcast when we put out the first episode of this. And I went and listened to the first two episodes, fell in love, binged it all, and told Brandon about it. And Brandon binged it, got it done before I did. So we decided that it was time to take it a little bit more seriously, a little bit more thorough. And we wanted to really give this the justice that we felt it deserved to all the families and all the victims that were involved in this tragedy.
I learned that Marshall Applewhite had some roots in Alabama, which I didn't know that prior to the podcast. That was kind of weird to find out.
Well, let's jump into this, man. So for those of you guys that don't know, a lot of times when you're talking about Heaven's Gate, most people will say that it was a group of fanatics, a cult. It's 39 men and women that died on March 26, 1997. And they would be right, because that's a lot of what the things, when they were, the bodies were discovered, they were discovered with just all black shirts. They had in the breast pocket of their shirts, they had roll of quarters and a $5 bill. They had a suitcase right next to them. They were all covered in purple shrouds, and they all had matching Nikes that were black decades with white swooshes on them. They all ingested phenobarbital. It was a cocktail. It was a mixture of phenobarbital and applesauce. They washed it down with vodka. And they did this in shifts, and we'll talk about the shifts here in a little bit, but prior to that, they had filmed themselves kind of like this go by, saying that they were being taken up by UFOs. And we're talking about this whole concept of a video diary suicide note, so to say. Like, did that ever strike you as a little bit weird about this whole thing, kind of doing research about it?
Oh, yeah. Dude, it was very, very weird. I mean, it was... A lot of that stuff, I had to, like, pause the show and kind of, like, rewind it a little bit and then pause again and think, what? Okay.
Yeah, and, I mean, this has gone down in U.S. history as the biggest, largest mass suicide in our history. 20 years these guys were together, but... The original design of what Heaven's Gate was meant to be, it never set out to be a suicide pact. It never intended to end that way. It just kind of happened that way. And so when you're talking about where Heaven's Gate ended, you have to, every everything in creation has an origin. So the origin of this started between 1970. It started in 1972 between two people who were known as T and Doe. And Brandon will talk a little bit more about them here in a second. But when they were recruiting people, they were often, a lot of the followers that they were getting were searching for something spiritual and something that was beyond this world, because that was a lot of the times the culture of the 70s. The 70s were a weird time.
Yeah, very.
So essentially the doctrine that they were writing up and going and preaching to people was that aliens had contacted Earth and were coming back. So essentially we were all vessels that were placed here and just waiting to enter into the next, waiting to go home essentially. You know, a lot of the followers that were coming and were joining T&O were people that were finding and looking for truth. They were expressing an openness for more, and they were looking, what they got was something that really wasn't mainstream. This is right around the times that Neil Armstrong had gone to the moon, and this was kind of sci-fi was really starting to take off in this times. This is around the area of Star Trek being popular, Star Wars starting to grow. So the idea and the concept of UFOlogy or UFOlogy really started becoming prevalent. And do you want to talk about their ad? Do you want to say anything about their ad campaigns real quick here?
Like their flyers and all that stuff?
Yeah. So the flyers would read UFOs. Who are they? Where do they come from? When will they leave?
Oh yeah. Kind of giving you like a little juicy intro to ponder on what their group's all about. Go listen to them.
I don't know. Like, if all honesty, like, if you saw something that it said, if you saw a flyer that said that, would that not intrigue you in the slightest bit?
Well, like, I would definitely want to be interested to hear what they have to say. Like, because it, is, you know, we hear so many things about UFOs and all that stuff, and it's like, I wonder if this person has like something new to put to the theory of all of things. But I would not want to go to like a meeting. I'd rather like, hey, can I get like a tape of this? It's on YouTube. But as far as the 70s, so that didn't happen.
Well, I mean, I feel like personally, like I would have gone to just because of the question of when will they leave. That to me is an intriguing point that say, you know, this is interesting. When will they leave? Like, I want to know, and I need to know more about what is this information that you possess that I don't have.
But then you'd leave and you figure out what they're really doing.
Yeah, that's true. Somewhere along the lines, I probably would have, you know, all right, this isn't for me, and then leave. But before they were T&O, they were called Bo and Peep. They were the founders of Heaven's Gate, and they told everyone that they were here from Earth. They came to this planet with messages for humanity, and once every 2,000 years, the next level, it opens up, and this terminology of next level was essentially you are in this life to prepare for the next life, which as Christians, in a way, we believe that, but what the Heaven's Gate cult believed is that you were really disciplining your body in this life so that you could gain access into the next life. Like, I believe personally that Jesus Christ came to die for all people. It wasn't the select people that if you have a relationship with him, you have interest into heaven. This one was essentially the ideology of having to gain and earn your salvation. And they essentially said you didn't have to die to go to heaven because your vehicle that was referred to as your body, you didn't actually have to do anything. You would just kind of, your spirit essentially would just go up. You never had to physically die. You would just be whisked away. A lot of the theology that they were pushing was sci-fi meets the Bible. That was a lot of their theology and a lot of how they kind of wrote what they believed and made their basis for it. And even, you know, going back again, they stated that if you came to join us, if you came to be our followers, that you really would live forever.
Yeah, definitely. That was their big thing, but it didn't say that way.
I mean, it didn't. Not by any means, but, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, if you had the chance for immortality on this earth, would you really want it? Because I think I've seen it explored in horror films that, you know, if a vampire, would you really want to see all your friends and family die? And then, you know, find new ones, and then all of them die, and then you're cursed kind of see all these people you love die. Like, I don't know that I would necessarily want to see that in this life.
No, I definitely wouldn't either. That'd be crazy. It's like a Tuck Everlasting. Never aging, man.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a good movie. T and Doe kind of go in. T and Doe. Oh my god. I'm so off track.
Do you not have notes?
I have notes. I just got off track because I didn't know you were finished for your part, and then you went into. And I don't even know where to start.
Alright. So just start at the top of your notes and go down.
Well, I just kind of go through, like, Bonnie Lou, how she changed her name, and then kind of, like...
Sounds good.
Okay. So T and Doe, before they're known as T and Doe, we had Bonnie Lou Nettles, who changed her name to T, started, she started Heaven's Gate, led her family to travel around with Marshall Applewhite Doe. As I was talking about earlier, Bonnie Lou had a family, and then things kind of fell apart from due to divorce, and she was kind of find some things to help her escape reality. And one night she's coming home from work, and she got home, and her daughter Terry, who was definitely a big part of this podcast that we listened to, they went outside and saw this light, and they moved in different directions. And we talked about how neat it would be if UFO came and took them away, and talked about, like, how cool it would be to see other planets because they felt like they didn't belong anymore. And that kind of, like, that right there kind of sparked something in Bonnie Lou Nettles to expand out and get into astrology, get into all kinds of different things. And she became a fan of I might butcher this word, theosophy.
That's close enough.
Which is like religion plus, it's like God plus astrology, charts, mysticism, ancient civilizations, personal awakening, lots of hidden meanings in science and in the stars. And then eventually she got so into it, she felt she could reach spirits. To read the stars, felt she had all these powers and connections. And then that's when she met Marshall Applewhite. Just a quick run through on who he is, who he was coming into meeting Bonnie Lou Nettles. He was raised in like a hellfire and brimstone church in Texas. He went to seminary to be a pastor like his father. He drops out because he wasn't happy there. Studies music, teaches music and does musicals, joins the army for a little bit. He makes a sandwich shop called the Sunshine Company. It goes under. By his mid-30s, he's divorced and had no job. Everything he's tried has failed. And he was struggling like with his sexuality, openly bisexual, and felt like he couldn't really connect on anyone on any human level. And his thing was he kept hearing these voices of God telling him things to do. And so when they met, this Marshall was visiting a friend in the hospital, and then he met Bonnie, who was a nurse there. And Bonnie does his astrological chart for him and says his fate was tied to hers. Bonnie can read all that stuff. And so from there, starts off there. They start hanging out. They opened a New Age Christian bookstore in Houston of books about Dead Sea Scrolls, ancient Christian mystics, Christian theosophical books, and occult books. It fails. They start a new one called The No Place. Then they decide they weren't supposed to serve. They decide they need to read the books and go on spiritual journeys and retreats. So that's when they decide to leave their life behind, leave everything behind, and go out and just abandon their family, abandon everything, and just become, like, just learn new things and learn, like, I guess kind of bring up their, what will become their teachings of, like, where they come to in their thoughts to do Heaven's Gate. They came to the conclusion that they were the two from Revelation in the midst of their journeys. And I'll read that to y'all real quick. And I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. If anyone would harm them, fire pours from their mouth and consumes their foes. If anyone would harm them, this is how he is doomed to be killed. They have the power to shut the sky that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. They have power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they desire. I'm going to scroll down and do 11 through 12. But after the 3.5 days of breath of life from God entered them, they stood up on their feet, and great fear fell on those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." They went up to the heaven in a cloud. Their enemies watched them. So that scripture, they looked so much into it that they felt like that voice was telling them, like, they were the two, like, they were the two that was talked about here, and so they went by the two. They took one giant step further. Space aliens and their rising, that they were space aliens and that they're rising from the dead, is it in extraterrestrial bodies, and they can change humans to that if they anyone wants to join them, they're welcome to join. So they tore around finding followers.
What they would do is they just traveled, like Brandon said, all over the United States, and they did it with the heart to really recruit people. And what they would do is, so in Ohio, they really started making a splash, and as these people were coming into this cult, the one thing that you would really find was that you had to change your ways. Like you couldn't enter in and be the same. So the idea was that you were changing completely. So you would have bland and ordinary haircut. You would wear bland and ordinary clothes. You didn't have beards. Men weren't allowed to have facial hair. And this was a symbol of vanity, this is what they believed, and so they would get rid of that. They would get rid of anything from your past life, and what they would essentially do is they would allow you into, they would give you a new name as well. And scripture is full of people getting new names. Saul became Paul, Levi became Matthew, Abram became Abraham, and so what they would do is they would give you a brand new name if you joined, and it would be some variation of Odie. Odie would, so maybe they would call you Nick Odie if you ever decided to join. They would give you brand new names that would end with that those Odie, essentially, is what it would. And they had definitely different terminologies for when you were referring to things that we refer to on the ordinary. A vehicle was called a human body. A home, a house, was called a craft. A kitchen was referred to as a Neutralab. And as you were answering in, you would have what is called a check partner. And this was essentially accountability to make sure that you were not becoming too human, that you were disciplining yourself for the next level. And your job was essentially the two of you guys would go out each day, travel a couple hundred miles, and really just spread the word of this gospel. And when people discovered a lot of the, you had, it was that, and then you had classroom time. And classroom time was when you would sit down and they would essentially teach you. T was the, was very much the heart and soul that would do this. There is known to have 125 recorded hours of this classroom setting. And it was essentially, this setting was how to get to the next level. It was, what do you need to do in this life to prepare for the next one? And you couldn't, they would train you essentially to where you couldn't understand with human minds. And this is known to be the only recorded voice that we have of Bonnie Lou Nettles. And in the hierarchy of this, of the way that this teachings would be evident, was that there was a hierarchy to the Heaven's Gate leadership where T was above Doe. So Bonnie Lou Nettles was above Marshall Applewhite. They were both check partners together, but she was older and wiser, that he's actually stated. And you couldn't have your own ideas essentially in this group. But the one interesting thing about this is that while they said that, you know, you really had to strip yourself of human emotions, T actually ended up writing to her daughter on this podcast. Heaven's Gate, what it does so well is that it showcases interviews, actual interviews with these people that are involved, and one of them being Bonnie Lou Nettles' daughter, who actually has 47 letters from her mom. And there's a point in the podcast where she's reading the notes and she says, by all means, conform to society.
The set, Terry Edels have a huge part in this podcast. So how she found out, but before she found out about her mother, Josh mentioned the note with her mom saying, by all means, conform to society. That I feel like those letters that she would read off really showed that, like, maybe her mom has some doubts, some regrets. Maybe, like, well, there's no turning back now. I've went this far in, you know, kind of like, and I'm sure, like, no one in that group had any idea that she was relaying these things to her daughter. Because, I mean, T was the leader of the whole thing, so. But, T actually ended up which was a big big change in the pace for the group. T passed away of cancer. But the thing is, though, she had been passed away for a while before Terry Nettles found out. And how she found out, two strange people came to her dorm to tell her that her mother had died. And they were being very weird about it. Like, they just came to the door. I asked for Terry, and that's it. And, Terry, like, at the time couldn't even tell, they couldn't even tell Terry at first that her mom had died. Like, they kind of beat around the bush about it. You know, like, they just said, hey, we tracked you down, you know, we're just here to check in. And then they finally told her. But before all this had happened, Terry had, you know, tracked down a number and almost reached her to reach out And when she called, like, her mom had already been dead, but they didn't say anything. You know, like, they kept it a secret. And they were saying how, like, they're going to stay in town to help her with it and everything and get over it. Except that this morning they're gone, and they left a letter with no explanation of her mom's death or anything. It just leaves her money and just says, like, you know, they have tasks to take care of. So, Doe eventually sends her a tape to explain things, and he sounded so broken and lost in this tape. Like, Doe explains that T had cancer, but didn't explain how cancer took her eye years ago. Doe says that, you know, like, Doe goes through, like, hey, you know, your mom loved you very much, but left because, like, she was so devoted to her Heavenly Father and her task. And you can just, like, listen to Terry, how you talked about this, like, years after, like, her voice, like, you know, like, so confused, like, as she just left her behind for this, like, a task, like, they call it. And Doe goes on to say, when T left her vehicle, that Terry's conscience must have known, said that they were torn on T's wishes to let Terry know. So Terry, or T, had left some wishes for Terry, like, to find out, and they, and Doe, like, kind of, like, saying, like, hey, your conscience must have known, Terry explained in this podcast, like, she had no idea. Like, how is she supposed to know? Like, you know, and it's just weird, too, before I continue on in my notes. In this tape, like, Doe just keeps talking, like, to Terry in the tape. Like, she's on board with everything, you know? Like, he keeps saying things to her as in, like, oh, yeah, she's part of this, too. Like, oh, she gets it. Like, and also acting like he's, like, her friend. Like, he's, like, someone who's, like, big in her life or whatever. So, when the task, one of the things that T wanted to be left to Terry was that when their task had ended, T wanted Terry to have all their teaching and documents. Doe says there'll come a time when he will get a signal to give it all to Terry. And, Terry explains that never happened. She never got any of it. She said if she did, she would burn it all. There's a lot Doe didn't tell Terry about the end of T's life. There was shock and confusion within the group. The members accepted it as a test of their faith for leaving Doe alone to lead them. Doe showed so much hurt and said he was praying for Terry and her healing. You could hear it, like, in Doe's voice in this tape. Like, he's showing, like, he doesn't know where to go now. Like, losing T really messed things up a lot for him and the group. And Doe now has to come up with something else. Like, he's left in a spot where, like, T was, like, a big part of everything, and now, like, she's gone, and, like, everything's just so different. And, but nothing they said that would happen, that have happened, like, that happened. Like, T didn't come back like they said that she would. And, that, I guess that put a lot of confusion on the group, too. And then, the last thing, remember, of the group who's still around today, who still really believes in this stuff, Sawyer, he talks in this podcast that he found a book when he was moving those things to T's old room. He found a book from the Hemlock Society, and it was a story about many ways of suicide. And which later has plays a big part in the group.
Yes and no, kind of moving forward, but he losing Bonnie Lou Nettles to him, it was a devastating blow to kind of the leadership, because for 10 years they had done things as a partner. He had looked at her as the ultimate authority figure, and they essentially had to rewrite their doctrine. So what ended up happening was, now T had gone home, and Doe was essentially the prophet at this point, and he had no idea what to do moving forward, so he sent everyone home. And when he sent everyone home, it was around 93, and we're going to be here at Victims and Villains, we're going to be doing a crossover that's going to be in April, all about the series Waco and the events of the Waco siege from 93. It's turning 25 this year. We also want to pay tribute to them, so be sure to check that out when that drops. But a lot of the news coverage was covering the Waco siege. And the Waco siege, the Waco siege was ended in, it's like the largest standoff in United States history. It lasted for 51 days. It was the FBI negotiating with the Branch Davidians, and the Branch Davidians was a sect of the Seventh-day Adventists who ultimately, long story short, it ended in a standoff, gunfire, came ablazing. 75 people ended up dead. 19 of them were children. And this kind of sparked something, as sadistic as this is. Doe didn't really see this as, you know, oh, well, I wonder. He really started pondering, will they follow me the way that David Koresh's followers followed him? That was ultimately ended up stirring up in him. And so what they did was they kind of went back to the drawing board. What Brandon talked about was they really had this like high in the beginning of the creation of them. They had this like high period where they were traveling and seeking and telling people, but then they also had this low period where they went underground, and after the Waco siege, they kind of really went back out and tried to get, you know, 15 more minutes of fame to really start recruiting. They started targeting. This is early days of the internet, so they would start, you know, targeting chat rooms and, you know, instant messengers and messaging boards, and they would start targeting UFO and sci-fi nerds. And when this resurgence kind of happened, and after everyone kind of came back from this hiatus, Doe was darker. He was more controlling. There was more emphasis on guns at this point, and he would be more sarcastic. And essentially, he kind of set him down in around 94, so about a year after this kind of new age of Heaven's Gate had begun. He really set people down in a group, and they had what I guess they would classify as a family meeting. And he pretty much flat out laid it out. He said, would you be willing to lay down your life for this cause? And he explained how they would do it, that they would drink this mixture called of phenobarbital applesauce and vodka. They would drink it, and he explained how it would work. And they just had this conversation, but he would put people on the spot in this kind of time. It was either you had real faith or you pretty much had false faith.
After the hiatus and getting more dark, though, they would eventually recruit new members as well, leading into the last few years of the group. And one new member that was very heavily featured, her name was Gail. And Gail was someone who was described as a very smart and popular girl, a girl very unlikely to have joined a cult. Within the podcast we listen to, like, it has her parents on, and they have like tapes and stuff of Gail. And one thing that was really crazy to me, when they mentioned like she was a very unlikely person to join a cult, she went on a trip with her dad at when she was 21, and like in the tape that they play, like, she seemed so happy to have this trip with her dad. Like, she was seeing, like, she was happy, goofing off, like, just having just the best time with her father at 21. She came home for where they lived, her and her boyfriend lived, to take a trip with her dad. And so eventually, after all that, Gail starts a shop selling, like, hippie stuff. And then she meets a new guy named Richard. And Richard, like, they talk about, like, planets and they make contact through crystals and copper wire, and eventually, like, her and Richard go off for this trip, and, like, her her and Richard, like, start hanging out, doing stuff a lot. Her friends don't see her as much, and, like, her friends just kind of get, like, she's just different. She's not acting how she does. So, Gail eventually came back home to her parents for a wedding, for a friend's wedding, and her mom mentions that she starts giving all her stuff away, which is very odd. And then they say Gail goes back out west, and her parents haven't heard from her in a long time. They call the landlord where she lived. The landlord tells her mom that her and Richard had left California, and she didn't know where they were at, but they left California. And Gail doesn't contact anyone for a year, and then this sends a postcard out of nowhere that she's fine. Then they start getting flyers in the mail, like UFO flyers, like a UFO thing in Michigan, but the thing in them passed. So they were kind of like wondering what's going on, so they reached out to, I think it was a nephew or something, and he knew someone at his college that knew a lot about cults and all this kind of stuff, because they kind of figured she was in a cult at that point. And his name was Paul Griswold, and he tells Gail's parents to come to a cult convention to learn how to deal with kids in a cult, because they wanted to try to talk to their daughter. But it's interesting hearing all this about, like, the convention and the book that this one dude wrote about it. The convention, they meet a lot of different families who are going through what they're going through with their kids, and then they find this guy who wrote a book about cult mind control. And he gets all these tips about, like, how to properly talk to your kid when they're going through the stuff with the cult, and pretty much has her brainwashed pretty much from the cult. And one day, she called. And one thing in the book said, like, have a recorder and record everything that you have with that person. So she called, and they need some tricks already. So they gave the call all they had, and tried to get her to come home just for a visit. So in the phone call, Gail's dad, like, seems to be very, he's been able to get her to crack when coming to visit. He keeps, like, bringing up stuff, like, hey, I'll buy you a ticket, like, come home. And she's kind of, like, questioning it. But before that, her grandma gets on the phone. Her grandma doesn't get it. Her grandma's just like, oh, Gail, come home, you know, like. Then her dad gets on there and kind of, like, plays up a little bit from what the book. And then as her dad's talking, they change the subject. She changes the subject, asking about her mom. So her mom comes up, and her mom is very different than her dad. Her mom keeps bringing up things that Gail enjoyed and got more out of Gail. Like, she brought up, like, the trip to Disney and all this kind of stuff. And Gail then tells her mom about her experience and her location, like, there in the Rocky Mountains and all that stuff. Like, Gail actually told them what was going on, so, like, they, like, oh my god, we actually might can find where she's at. But that would be the last time they hear from Gail. By 97, Gail is going by Iris Odie, and in her exit video, she sounds so calm and smiling and sounds sincere about her exit. And and the rest of this pretty much is just like but the brainwashing that went through in the group, and having everything out of your head that you had in there, just so you can be dedicated to your leader. So you can, you know, focus on just this group, and eventually focus on doing things to your leader and doing things to get to the next level.
Which is so weird that, you know, as they're, again, talking about these exit videos, that they're so calm and that there's so much peace in them, that what they're doing is great. It's a good thing. And it's really weird because it's very rare that when someone commits suicide or even contemplates suicide that they speak with joy, that they even have joy leading up to this. But that's the thing, that these guys were so deep into their theology that they believed in everything that they were doing. And every part of this suicide was planned out, like, to the T. They called it the routine. Every last place of this was planned out. So how this suicide occurred and how this took place was that there was three or four groups. So I will probably correct that number as I go along. But the first group assisted, there were 15 suicides. And so the way the suicide would work is that there was 15 bodies, but there was 8 assists. And 15 suicides, what they would do is they had what they called a flight bag, which was essentially the tools that they felt like they needed for the next, going through the next life or making that transition. They had a roll of quarters and a $5 bill in their breast pocket, as I had previously mentioned, and they would drink the cocktail of phenobarbital, the applesauce, and the vodka, and they would drink it, put a plastic bag over their head. It was supposed to essentially be instantaneously, and what this cocktail did to the body was, first you would be drowsy, and then it would put you in a coma, and it would actually, within 10 minutes, actually collapse your entire circulatory system. The drink was painless, and it took, like I said, took about 10 minutes or less to actually work. Then what the helpers would do, the people that were assisting these suicides, they would remove the bag from their head, and they would put a purple shroud above them. And many people, there's been kind of talk about why the shroud was purple and why, what it had to do with, and in Christian culture, the color purple means royalty, and it was something that in the Old Testament a lot of the kings would always be covered in purple, was because they were royal kings of Christ or of God. But it was also Bonnie Lou Nettles' favorite color. So was it really for God, or was it in memory of the leader that had become God? The second group consisted of 15, and the third group consisted of 7. So the fourth group was actually 2 people, and they had no help. They pretty much did everything themselves. They had no shrouds. When the bodies were discovered, they actually had bags over their head. There was no interruption. This was as peaceful as they could possibly get. And what he would do, so they picked this day specifically on March 26, 1997, because this was the highlight of where the Hale-Bopp comet was actually going to be, and they believed that the ship that was behind Hale-Bopp was actually the ship that was going to be taking them home. So this is the reason why. But prior, leading up to that day, Doe had sent out 5 packages to 5 different people all over the country that he had trusted. And when he opened up the box, it was 2 videotapes, a set of instructions, and a computer disc. And the instructions that were received by a former member whose name was Rio said, go to the kitchen. So go to the kitchen side door. Rio goes to the kitchen, opens up the side door, and what he finds is these bodies. So he videotapes it and call the cops. There's 39 bodies in total, like we had said. And there are still there are some people in the cult that didn't go through with it on the 39. However, Chuck Humphreys, who was known in the group as Rakoti, in April 97, he actually tried with another member, Wayne Cook, who went by Justody, to actually go home to see them, to see themselves. And Wayne Cook succeeded. His wife was actually one of the people that the 39 that had actually committed the suicide in March. This is a month later. And Chuck had something kind of go wrong. So he survived, But he went to, after the survival, he went to spend some time in the hospital, which progressed into the mental ward, which actually progressed into, he believed that the reason something went wrong with his suicide was because he was supposed to spread the theology, which connected him to Ben Zeller in Rochester, New York, who believed in the message, and a bond and a friendship pretty much joined, and he succeeded in taking his life the second time. And so for most people out there that are probably listening to this, when you talk about Heaven's Gate, you probably know that there were only 39 that were found. There were 4 more bodies that were added to this tragedy as well. You also have Wayne Cook, Jim Simpson, Wayne Parker, and Chuck Humphreys, totaling 43 different people. So that is the tragedy as Heaven's Gate. Speaking of something a little bit lighter, this is Brandon's wrestling moments.
All right, so today we're talking about, or tonight, we're talking about, whenever you're listening to this, we're talking about one of the greatest, if not the greatest rivalry from the 90s in professional wrestling. And I'm talking about Masato Tanaka versus Mike Awesome, which some people who may have just been casual fans of like WWF and WCW. When you hear Mike Awesome, you might think of his terrible run in WCW. You'll think of his 2 characters, that 70s Mike or the Fat Chick Thriller, which is a terrible gimmick.
Wait. He had a alias called That 70s Mike.
Yes. You see his mullet in the match I sent you?
I did.
Yeah, and then after that, they had what they called Nitro Girls. They were just like the cheerleaders, I guess, for Nitro. And they had one. I think her name was Beef? Beefy? No? I don't remember her name, but she was like a bigger woman. Like, she was meant to be there for this reason. But then his character became, he was like this dude who was really into big girls. They called him the Fat Chick Thriller.
Wow. Okay, then.
But like before all this, though, like he was just like this complete, just awesome, like bad A dude in ECW and in Japan, all over everywhere else. So it's like when I talk to someone who just like casually knows who he is because of that, I think Mike Awesome's one of your favorite wrestlers. But see, when I think it, when I hear Mike Awesome's name, I think of Masato Tanaka. I think of their many classics they had in ECW. So just a rundown of their rivalry. The rivalry between these two began when Awesome was achieving great success in FMW, which is a now defunct promotion from Japan that did a lot of crazy stuff in Japan. They did a lot of like the exploding barbed wire matches and just some really crazy stuff, really ultra violent. This feud started in 97. He held numerous titles, including the promotion's independent heavyweight championship and the World Street Fight 6-man tag team championship. By the end of 97, Tanaka had defeated Awesome for all of his championship belts, kicking off a rivalry that would finally end when the two met at one last time at the WWE produced ECW One Night Stand that happened in 2005. So the Awesome Tanaka feud hit ECW in 1998 and produced some of the most exciting matches in the history of the promotion. Their back and forth battles at major ECW events like Heat Wave, which is the match I sent to Josh. Before I keep going, what do you think about that match that I sent you from Heat Wave?
I did not expect that ending, in all honesty.
Oh, yeah, man. Dude, Tanaka, man. He freaking got the win he deserved.
Tanaka was like a guy. Tanaka compared to Mike Awesome is a little guy. And I just... Tanaka looks like he was getting ready to just be beat like 3 minutes into that match. Like halfway through, he just looked like he was just not going to make it. So the ending to me really surprised me.
Yeah, that's the thing with their matches, because like Tanaka always took the worst end of the beating from Mike Awesome. I mean, those unprotected chair shots to the head were just not necessary. And Tanaka always find a way to get that comeback and just go all out. And Heat Wave was a great one, and then they had one November to Remember is really good. And that one, and those are still looked at upon as classics by many of the wrestling faithful. And at the Anarchy Rules 99 pay-per-view, Austin defeated Tanaka. And then the ECW World Heavyweight Champion Taz in a triple threat elimination match to become the top champion in ECW. So awesome in the match, it was triple threat, awesome, Tanaka, and Taz. Taz was about to go to WWF. So awesome in the match limited Taz well early. So the match came down to him and Tanaka, which the fact that his first title win was against Tanaka was great. And I was reading Mike Awesome had two runs as champion. Both came from defeating Tanaka. And then Tanaka's first win as champion came from beating Mike Awesome. So you see like how entwined these two are to their career. One of the reasons why this feud holds a special place in my heart for sure, though, is because like these two dudes went out there. They could be the main event. They could be the first match, middle match. It can be a show that's not televised. It could be just like a house show. These two went out there. They enjoyed working with each other so much so that their one objection is just, hey, when this whole show is over with, I want everybody talking about us. And they did that. Like every match that they had. Like, there's not one match that they've had in ECW or FMW anywhere in the world that is not good. Like, they have never had a bad match together. And some of the top rivalries in the 90s, like, you know, with your Austins, your McMahons, your Hogan's, Flair's, all that stuff, even the 80s, like, there's moments in those rivalries that were just cringeworthy. But you can't even name one cringeworthy moment in this rivalry. I mean, you really can't. Like, they were just... Man, I don't even know. Like, to me as a fan, like they did a lot for me as a fan growing up. But going forward in their career after the 90s, they didn't touch again until 2005, which was the last time they wrestled. It was ECW's One Night Stand. And sadly, it ended up being Mike Awesome's last match. 2007, his friends found him. He had hung himself. And, it was such a out-of-nowhere thing. I mean, that dude was seriously one of the greatest. I mean, you saw him in the video. I mean, he was a big guy. Like,
oh, yeah.
He did things that guys his size should not do. And Mike Awesome was literally, I mean, he's very underrated as a start of evolution of kind of defining the, like, yeah, you're a bigger dude, so you shouldn't do these things small guys can do. No, if you can do it, you do it. Like, Mike Awesome was definitely a big name. So that was a big tragedy in 07 when it came out that he had passed away. He had taken his own life. And in Tanaka, he still wrestles today, actually, in Japan. But, you know, those two will forever be connected. I mean, they did a lot for me and my wrestling fandom, just watching those matches. It's hard to find a rivalry. I mean, I can honestly say there has not been a rivalry in wrestling to me that compares to them. I mean, you have your Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, but like, if you're listening to this and you really enjoy independent wrestling, I want to encourage you to check out these two dudes, and their names are Gary J and Jake Parnell. They have a rivalry going on right now all over the South, the Southeast, Midwest. It's going on for, like, I guess, a year. And it is literally, and a lot of people, like, I've said this and people have agreed, and I've seen people say it, it is literally the closest thing we'll ever get to a modern day Tanaka and Mike Awesome. Even the wrestlers that I mentioned and that feud have agreed with it. Like, I tweeted at Jake Parnell and said that about the feud, and he tweeted back and was like, dude, that's a very accurate description of our rivalry. So if you have some time, like, y'all go check their stuff out. Like, it's the closest thing you'll ever see to that. But that's my wrestling thing. Go check out Mike Awesome, Tanaka's matches, any match from the 90s. I mean, they only had one match in the 2000s. That was the last one they ever had. It was Mike Awesome's very last match. But anything from the 90s that they did, like, you have to see everything they've ever done together. I mean, just phenomenal. And I was really excited that I decided to do this because I felt like I don't get to talk about them enough. So yeah, man. So final thoughts on them before we go to you for your next thing.
I'm gonna say it's a tragic because I loved it the way that I'm not a wrestling guy by any means, but I will watch wrestling for this show, and the way that the announcer or the commentators really, as they're talking about the way that and even the way that Brandon's talked here, is that Mike Awesome moved in the way that no one his size should ever move. Dude was like a bear on a bunny rabbit weight. Like, just the way that he moved, it was so graceful. And, like, the moment where he just, like, got up on the he gets up on the ropes and just goes after Tanaka in the audience, I was like, dang.
Oh, yeah, man.
Dang, savage.
His suicide dives were some of the best in the business. I mean, like, in the ending of their match in One Night Stand, and then, like, Mike Awesome, he Awesome bombs Tanaka through a table from the ring, and you're just seeing Tanaka laying on the ground. Next thing you know, you just see Mike Awesome just clear the rope and just dive right on top of him from the ring. It is insane. I mean, that dude, man. I mean, even in 2005, like, a few years before he died, like, he was still, like, absolutely, like, the freaking man. And, I mean, Tanaka, I don't know where I'd rank him in my favorite wrestlers. I mean, like, is I only really watched his stuff with Mike Awesome and stuff in ECW, but Mike Awesome would definitely rank in probably my top 10, top 15 at least probably top 10. I mean, he was huge for me, like, getting in. Like, he was huge for me when I was starting to realize there was more to professional wrestling than the entertainment side, because, I mean, you had WWF that was, like, the flashy, like, spectacle and the giant type thing, and then you had WCW that was like just the good old brother sister wrestling company, and then ECW came in pretty much how Nirvana came in, you know, just like, hey, we're a lot different than you, we're better than you, we're gonna prove it. And I watching that stuff as a kid, the tapes and stuff, like, really resonated to me. And then I grew up to be a punk hardcore kid that love independent wrestling, just how I love hardcore. So those two, like the match we covered a while back with Jerry Lynn and RVD, those two definitely have a big impact on me as a fan and many others. So that's that. Go check it out.
We'll have links on our Facebook.
Yeah, I'll put some links that I can find to all their matches. Because there's a lot of them on Daily Motion and a couple on YouTube, so we'll definitely have those up there. Check them out.
So I am actually not doing a music spotlight for this week. A couple of weeks ago, I did a spotlight on a band that most people know as being Too Sexy. And
oh, no.
Right Said Fred, their debut album, Up. And I found this at a thrift store for $1. I paid 50 cents for it. I thought it would be a cool idea to review this and kind of give more oversay than just this song that they know. And a lot of what we covered in the previous coverage with them is that they were actually a more rock-based band. But I'm going to say this. So the album opens up on a song called A Love for All Seasons, and the vocalist knows how to sing, and it's like, it's just him and a piano, and it sounds beautiful, and I was like, okay, all right. And then there's a pause, and then there's all this dance music, and literally, that's all the first three songs are. The first three songs are nothing but dance, electronica, club music, that all sound exactly the same. And I felt like Brandon listening to my cup of music. I was like, this is lame. But there's a shift. In the fourth track, it's called, if I can find where I put it, Do You Feel? And Do You Feel is something that is different from the album that you hear so far. And there's a lot more that's like that. Like, there's, it's weird because, like, the way that the album progresses is that there is a build-up, but it's accompanied nicely. Like they're, the just everything together is, everything about this song in particular is, just flows nicely. And soulful, there's a, it crescendos to a point where there's a soulful harmony match between the vocalist and a, I guess it would be a kind of like a choir singer, but it, like, the two of them back and forth is like haunting, but where you have one high, you have another low. The next track dips into just random choir lyrics that feel like they're written by a 5-year-old, and dance music, and the dance music aspect of this album is where it's the weakest. But there is, I am going to say this, that the strongest point is when it's just a stripped down performance. Deepy is just an acoustic guitar. There's a little bit of horns in there, but it builds, and it's a great place where you can just showcase the vocals of this band. And I love that. I love that. There's another great one where the way that it ends, it starts off really bad, but the way that this album ends, it ends on a track called Upon My Heart, and it dials back to sounding like early Maroon 5 almost, because it has this rock meets funk. It definitely sounds like something that you would hear in the very first Maroon 5 album, and it's the strongest point in here. It's got the best lyrics of the album. It hits a little bit of REM influence in here as well. No, I'm sorry. That's all those simple things. Upon My Heart and Those Simple Things, they are the strongest of the album. But I mean, all in all, like, the dance numbers in this album, you lose so much potential, because the dude and the band behind these albums and these songs and the I'm Too Sexy, there's definitely a lot there that could have potential, but you ultimately lose it because the band just gets, it's too overplayed, and all of these tracks just kind of blur together and you can't picture one from the other. But where they're stripped down and where they're showcasing the vocals is a good thing. But all in all, I got to give it a 2.5 out of 5. It was, I don't know if it was worth my dollar or not, because it was only like 3 good songs.
That's why there's Spotify.
Look, man, I like holding the physical thing in my hand.
So say that thing Stan Lee once said about comic books.
Oh, the comic books are like boobs?
Yeah. he would hate me for being a digital comic guy now.
Yes, he would. but if you guys are listening to this right now, and we've dealt with some pretty heavy stuff tonight, talking about Mike Awesome and his untimely death in 2007 and the tragedy of Heaven's Gate. The reason we put out this content, the reason we do this show, is to let you guys know that there's hope. To let you guys know that there is a light at the end of that dark tunnel. So if you guys or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that occur each and every day. And for every successful one of those suicides, that's 25 more being attempted. That's 3,075 suicides, roughly one death every 12 minutes right here domestically. And internationally speaking, there are over 800,000 that take place every year. That's one death roughly every 40 seconds. So please, if you're struggling or you know someone who is, reach out, because tomorrow may be too late. You guys can reach out to us on any of our social media, any of the social media for victims and villains as well. You guys can also call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255, or also text anonymously to 741-741. But where can people find you, man?
You can follow me at Twitter at BrandonPSMC, and then you can also follow me on Instagram at EmoBubba, which I think about changing that name, but if I do, I'll let y'all know. So where can I find you at?
You guys can find me everywhere at Victims and Villains, because I'm not really too much of a social guy. I now have a Snapchat that you can find at Captain Nostalgia, but I only use it like every now and then. So I'm trying to get better at it, you know?
Yeah, I haven't really used mine since I got my Instagram back going again a few months ago. So I ain't missing out on much.
See, I balance everything though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You don't do that. Anyways. We'll be back next week and then next time, and until then, remember, keep chasing the 90s.
So, whoop.